The Guardian. Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. I'm Melissa Rudd, standing in for Max Rushton. David De Gea keeps Spurs out at Wembley as Manchester United win 1-0. Did he prove he's the best keeper in the world, or was he just a bit lucky? Liverpool maturely march on. Emery's revolution at Arsenal feels a bit too similar. Burnley win without having a shot on target, and Neil Warnock goes full on Brexit. In the Championship, Leeds spies cause shockwaves, while in Spain, magical Messi hits 400 goals. All that plus loads more in today's Guardian Football Weekly. We have a stellar lineup this morning. Jonathan Wilson's here.
Morning.
Jonathan, just tell everyone what you had for breakfast, because when you told me, I didn't know what the first two things were, and I just want to see if I'm the only person who listens
to the podcast. Okay, I have to do it in the same order now, because I'm assuming you know what clementines are and crisps.
Yep.
I had Morbier and Comte for two cheeses. But I was emptying the fridge because I'm off back to Sunderland today. So, it wasn't my normal breakfast. I'm not happy about it. But, you know, you can't always have berries and seeds and nuts and nice things.
Barney Roney, did you have berries and seeds and nice things?
No, I didn't. But presumably you also had ice cubes, frozen peas, a strange mouldy thing in a glass, an old clove of garlic that gets stuck down the bottom.
I mean, I did throw out some rotten shallots, that is true.
God, you've really changed. Going back to Sunderland on the back of throwing out some rotten shallots, that's shocking.
You still didn't have to say what you had, Barney. Are you trying to keep it quiet from us?
No, I had, honey nut mini shredded wheat, which is actually very nice, but you have to put a very small amount in the milk because they get soggy very quickly. You did ask.
Yeah, I did, and you told.
Is that your tactical advice?
Yeah, that's about tactical.
Because you're not always in favour of tactical advice on the pod, are you?
It depends who it's coming from. There's some very good people out there. I don't know if you've seen them on the internet. Some very Michael Cox, he's good. I don't know if you've seen him. He's excellent.
Barry, you're back from your holiday.
I am, yes. Hello.
Did anyone guess where you'd gone? I didn't. I saw one tweet.
Yes,
I didn't
quite
see.
A few people guessed Malta. I think it was the possible presence of W.H. Smith, Marks and Sparks, Tesco and Costa coffee shops.
So England, but a bit sunnier.
No, it was very cold and wet. Not one of the great holidays.
Well, on that note, we better start with the football. And we'll start with the biggest game of the weekend. Spurs 0, Manchester United 1. Marcus Rashford's goal just before half-time, the difference. Tottenham, though, did force David De Gea into 11 saves. Pochettino afterwards saying that it was one of the best Spurs performances in his tenure. Barney, you were at Wembley. Is there anything in that?
It was a really good game, I have to say. I really enjoyed it. And it wasn't a game of two halves. It was a game of two-thirds and one-third, the first two-thirds of which I thought Solskjaer's plan worked really well. And Man United were very aggressive, pressing at the front. And then they seemed to really tire, after which Spurs, you know, absolutely sort of battered them. But I guess maybe what Pochettino is talking about is that they did create loads and loads of chances, but they spent that final half hour with Christian Eriksen and Harry Winks as their central midfield, which, you know, is a rejig of the team that you probably wouldn't ideally want. They have quite a thin squad in that area. I know some people disagree with that, but I think they do. And they came up against a goalkeeper who made the same save about 10 times. A really good save, but he's got that one thing he does where he blocks it with his feet. And it was incredible. I mean, people have said it was lucky. I suppose he's lucky in that he's a really good goalkeeper, and they're lucky in that they have a really good goalkeeper and pay him £200,000 a week. And goalkeepers are part of the team too.
Yeah, this is it. I mean, people say it's lucky, but I mean, do we have to start discounting goals where the keeper should have done better? I mean, because
Barcelona are lucky. They've got that Messi fella. He's pretty good, isn't he?
Well, and also De Gea does this repeatedly. It's not the first time he's made a series of saves with his feet.
No,
I mean, he did it against Arsenal last season. There's a game I always think of was, I think it was the first game Brendan Rodgers went to the 3-4-2-1 at Liverpool, and United won 3-0, but Liverpool were actually probably the better team that day, just De Gea made another series of fantastic saves. So De Gea is a really good goalkeeper. I don't think that's luck. I think you're right.
Well, I think what the naysayers are pointing out is that the shots were kind of straight at him. I agree with you completely, but the finishing could have been a little better.
Probably could have been better, but also De Gea his because his positioning is good, he encourages the ball to come to him. You know, if you take up the right position, you don't have to stretch as far. And I think there's a psychological aspect as well that he's very good at sort of projecting himself somehow. And so forward to sort of aware he's there. And I guess once he's made a couple of those saves, the forward start to think, oh, Christ, he's having one of those days again where we're never going to get past him.
That is quite interesting. I'm not... Goalkeeping is a really technical thing, and we also have opinions about it, and it probably annoys goalkeepers when we do. But the Rashford goal, we were really in line with that. Could see him running through where we were sitting in the press box. And you did think, well, there's only one place he can score. You could see where Lloris was standing. It could only go in that exact spot, and the ball would go in the net, and there would be no way he could save it. And he put it in exactly that spot. But you did wonder if there was some other way you could somehow cover more. You know, I would really, really interested to hear a goalkeeper.
Not that I thought it was at the time, but looking at the replay, when you see the camera behind the goal and you see the break happens and Pogba plays that great pass, and I think the pace of that pass, or not the pace of the pass, but the speed of the movement of the ball from sort of 10 yards inside the United half to the Spurs box is so quick that Lloris's retreat has to be very quick. And I think because of the pace of that, maybe his positioning was slightly off. Which, I mean, that's not saying it's a mistake, but yeah, if you were being sort of incredibly critical, incredibly precise about it, probably his positioning was not where he ideally would have liked to have been.
Well, maybe he makes a different decision and comes out and the finish hits his foot and everyone says, oh, it was a rubbish finish, you know, but it was actually the kind of good goalkeeping you don't, or luck, that you don't often notice.
It was a good finish by Rashford and a lovely pass, as you say, from Pogba. And he had a really good game, didn't he, Barney?
Pogba? Yeah, he was really good. He was really good in the first hour. I mean, then Man United's midfield just completely disappeared. So I guess he was a part of that. But no, he looked like exactly... At one point, he ran... The balls were bouncing about 40 yards out. And he just sort of bundled his way past two players, bundled his way past someone else and almost scored. And you kind of... The whole sort of Man United fans rose at that moment. You kind of, that was the moment people in English football have been wanting him to do that. You know, that's what we want him to do. He's large and strong, and we want him to surge through the middle of what was quite a small Spurs midfield.
I'm intrigued by your point about United fading physically.
When you say intrigued, you mean like fuming?
Yeah, inside, yeah. But let's go with intrigued for now. Under Mourinho, they didn't run much, right? That was a constant thing, that their running stats were less than the vast majority of teams, if not everybody in the Premier League. So I'd watched the game and thought that change that happened sort of early in the second half was because Pochettino had switched to a 4-3-3-1, which I think is part of it. But I wonder if United actually aren't very fit, and that was one of the things that went wrong under Mourinho. That hadn't occurred to me before. That's why I say I was intrigued.
Well, intrigued.
I see you so often do, but you've reached a part of my brain that doesn't often get prodded.
Yeah, another thing that hadn't occurred to you previously. But Lingard definitely looked really tired in the last 20 minutes because he had run like a maniac. You know, he's playing a different role, and he played it really well. But maybe they do need intensive fitness training to play.
But it's only natural that they would tire, isn't it, if they're not used to running at that, for that length of time and at that intensity.
I mean, to be fair, that does feel like an area of your expertise.
I've read a lot about Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, wishing Pochettino, and he had this plan which worked, but it wasn't really rocket science, was it? Is he getting too much credit for just having a plan, whereas his predecessor never really seemed to have one, apart from try not to lose?
But quite a lot of football isn't rocket science, is it? It's having the bravery to actually do that. He changed his formation to try and close down where Spurs play the ball out from at the back and to interrupt their possession game. And you can sort of, this is the sort of thing people say on, well, why don't you do this on Twitter or something? But to actually do that as a manager and to take the consequences of doing it is a really big deal, because it could have gone horribly wrong. And you say, why did you play this guy at centre forward? He scored 2 goals in 30 games or whatever it is. But he did it and trained the players to do it. And you do have to give him some credit. It's not that complicated. A game football, sorry, Jonathan.
And then, I think credit to Pochettino as well for reacting to that by shifting from a diamond to a 4-3-3-1. And then Solskjaer wasn't able to react to that. But that's not to sort of say anything wrong with what Solskjaer did. Maybe his players were just tired and you can't just react to that. But I think Pochettino is more flexible than pretty much anybody else in the Premier League in terms of his willingness to switch formations. I think he's very good at that in-game changes.
And he was hampered a bit because Sissoko was forced off.
Well, he's hampered a lot. I mean, you know, again, something Barney touched on there. Your credit where it's due. The centre back midfield, they really are short of numbers now. If Dembele does go to Beijing with Wanyama out, with Dier still coming back from his appendectomy, if they've lost Sissoko as well, that's Winks, who I think looked pretty tired against Chelsea. Was you know, the only two players they took off on yesterday were Sissoko's of injury and Winks with, 10 minutes ago, something like that.
Yeah, and Eriksen's the best creator and he was playing deep. I think that's why Pochettino said, as you said, Mel, that he was proud of his players, because but for those saves, you know, they probably win the game and they've done it on a shoestring.
But if they've lost Son to the Asian Cup and Kane's ankle, whatever's the problem is there, you look pretty bad as he hobbled off at the end.
That's got to be a worry, because Llorente came on and possibly he had the best chance. Sort of the ball fell to him 6 yards out and he literally just rolled straight to the head.
Yeah, he just sort of got caught between his feet.
But that was
it?
A brilliant save. Fantastic save.
But they've not got that strength in depth, have they?
Well, no. I suppose Lamella or Moura will come in for Son and they'll have to play Llorente, although there was talk that Llorente would be moving somewhere else, but they kind of have to keep him there.
Yeah, they can't, unless they've got somebody else to come in, they've got to keep him, because they just need bodies.
Yeah.
I mean, I can't work out if the issue in midfield is to do with the lack of spending, because I think most clubs, if you lose three first-choice central midfielders, would have problems. But then it really does highlight the fact they didn't spend when you do get a problem like that.
And I think on the bench yesterday, the three central defenders and
three defenders.
I think Oliver Skip, was he on the bench as well?
Yes, he was.
I mean, he's still 17 or 18. And he's a really amazing player in many ways, because physically he's really, really strong and he just runs and runs and runs. But there's no doubt they just haven't got a deep enough squad there. You can't really ask him to come on and change a game like that.
For Solskjaer, 6 wins from 6 games. I don't really understand this debate where everyone says, well, you know, he should get the job. Let's give him a chance. He's got until the end of the season, so why are we judging him after 6 games? Surely he can.
Because that's what people do. It's knee jerky. I mean, at the moment, he's making a very good case for himself. We'll see what happens when, or if things start to go wrong. But you know, Manchester United fans are happy. Their team is playing good football. The players are clearly happy. So, you know, on the evidence of what we've seen so far, why not give him the job? But yeah, there's no rush in making a decision.
Well, and the main case against him is what happened at Cardiff, but he had a weak squad. He came in halfway through the season and couldn't keep him up. So maybe we shouldn't hold that too heavily against him. And Alex Ferguson always said that he thought Solskjaer would be a great manager. He thought the way Solskjaer read the game was as good, if not better, than any other player we work with. So
you wonder, you know, what is the point of Man United at this stage? And it's presumably, you know, he makes everyone feel good. They play nice football. He's on brand. I mean, that these things will be really important to the people who make this decision. Possibly the point of Man United isn't actually to win trophies right now, if you own the club. I'm not talking from a fan's perspective, obviously. And right now, everyone's very happy and it seems to be working fine.
Well, there are reports before the game that Gareth Southgate is in line for the United job. He wasn't at the game. He was at Everton Bournemouth, which, well, he made an error there because that game was terrible. But, you know, would he be a good fit?
Personally, I don't think so, but I have my doubts about Southgate tactically anyway. I think his failure to respond in the second half against Croatia in the semi-final was poor. I think the substitutions he made against Colombia were poor. I think there's been a tendency for England under Southgate to fade in the second half. But other managers seem to outthink him tactically. He's clearly done a lot of other things very, very much right. And probably in international level, those other things are more important. So Southgate's been a great thing for English football. Does that translate into a big club job? I'm not sure.
Well, these accusations against Southgate are exactly the same criticisms you just made of Solskjaer as well. So presumably you're ruling him out.
Well, they're not, are they? I didn't say that.
Was faded in the second half, didn't respond to Pochettino's shift, bad substitutions.
Because Solskjaer is
presumably not English.
There are extenuating circumstances that Solskjaer can point to. I think his work in the first half leaves him on the credit side tactically. But I think what he's done in the six games mean that we need to reassess what he's done at Cardiff. I think Solskjaer's making a very good case for himself.
While
acknowledging some doubts about him still in that regard.
I'm glad you have those doubts. But Southgate, I mean, what he's really good at is standing there looking like he's full of integrity and talking really with real feeling about being English and things like that.
The way he pronounced the letter U, I think he's very good at that as well.
Right. But he's really good at that. I just don't know if those skills are transferable to the Manchester. Can we bear seeing him every week standing there
he's
looking
waistcoat.
Like one of the founding fathers, like radiating integrity, talking about whatever, the pot noodle partner in Asia? I don't know.
Just before we move on from this game, we praised Pogba, so in the interests of balance, we should mention that tackle on Dele Alli where he kind of stamped on his knee. Jamie Redknapp, in commentary, said, oh, he didn't mean to do that. He's just trying to put his body in the way of the ball. But it was nasty and it could have led to a bad injury.
Yeah, I thought it was a red card. I couldn't quite understand what Jamie Redknapp was trying to say. He said he'd done a way worse one, but that it wasn't intentional. And, well, it doesn't really matter, Jamie. It's still a red card.
What he said didn't make any sense because he said he was trying to protect himself from the ball, from the player as he took the ball away, which was exactly what he was doing, but that it wasn't deliberate. So it clearly was deliberate because it was part of something
to do,
was trying to do. But I think it's one of those ones that looks much worse in freeze frame. Even though the player, Dele Alli, was shocked, he did actually jump up because the contact was quite brief. It just looked quite bad.
Well, it sort of scraped down the side of his thigh rather than catching him full on, didn't it? But I don't know, I think I probably should have been a red.
Well, let's move on to Brighton against Liverpool. 1-0 Liverpool, Salah penalty early in the second half. Brighton did make it difficult for Liverpool without having a shot on target.
I think it's one of those games where we're obliged to say it's the kind of game title winners grind out without being impressive. And Liverpool have won a lot of games this season without being impressive, and that was another one.
Klopp afterwards called it the most mature performance of the season. Do you agree with that?
I guess so. It's a good 1-0 away win with a penalty that involves someone diving, so I guess that's mature. I don't know. I don't want to see them playing mature football. I want to see them running around like headless chickens, chasing people down and winning 5-3. Although I accept that's probably not the best way to win the league. Hopefully they'll do that towards the end. It was a very routine kind of game where one team simply had better players than the other one, and in the end I didn't understand why it was number one on match of the day at all. I kept waiting for something really dramatic to happen at the end because it was a fairly routine, fairly dull kind of win, I thought. But yeah, like Barry says, we're obliged to say this now means they'll probably win the league.
And Fabinho doing well at centre back.
Mm. Yeah. Which is not surprising. He's quite a sort of powerful player.
Yeah, and I think the modern vogue for playing with a high line means that often a good defensive midfielder is as good a fit as a centre back in a back four.
Well, I put Liverpool 7 points clear at the top. Man City take on Wolves in the Monday night game later on. Brighton are 13th. Chelsea beat Newcastle 2-1. They opened up a 6-point gap over Arsenal in fifth. Pedro and Willian with the goals. Chelsea's winner in particular. Lovely to watch. Really good from Hazard.
Terrible from Yedlin, though.
Yeah.
I mean, what a surprise. Williams caught onto his right foot. I mean, I was awful from Yedlin.
Did you like the bit on Match of the Day 2 where they showed that, where I thought it was really interesting, the player behind Yedlin was yelling at him, telling him to show him down the line, pointing and yelling. He had made that calculation and was yelling at his teammate, which I think is just really interesting that players do that, and that he had the presence of mind to do it, and that we often sort of probably imagine professional footballers are simply running around with their heads in the air. But, you know, that he was yelling at his teammate, I found very interesting. But he didn't do it.
He didn't do it.
It reminded me of the time we were walking home from a live gig at the Emmanuel Centre and I nearly got mown down by a bicycle, but you saved my life by shouting at me and gesturing.
Well, I was shouting and gesturing at you anyway.
Presumably you did it, though. You moved and didn't get mowed down, whereas
I listened to my teammate.
Unlike Yedlin, you could learn a lot from us in that scenario.
Well, Sarri said afterwards Chelsea didn't attack the box enough. But, you know, they didn't play any strikers. Morata was left out. He said he'd rather play small players and that having two strikers on the bench would be useless.
I really enjoy Sarri's honesty. He's like no compunction about digging out players, you know, pointing out what they've done wrong or what the team as a collective have done. But he just seems to do it with a lot more charm than Jose Mourinho used.
But he used the word useless as well. The question about Morata, oh no, that would be completely useless.
No, but I think what he said made complete sense. Newcastle often play in away games with three centre-backs, as he did there. The three centre-backs are all big players. So Clark, Lejeune and Lascelles. Morata would struggle to win aerial balls against those three. And so therefore try and attack him on the ground.
But various managers have tried to use Hazard in this role. And
I don't think that's ideal. I agree with that. But I also think his reason for not playing Morata made sense.
But is it just that he's not happy with the strikers he has rather than...
Well, I guess ideally you'd have a striker who whose strength was not, in theory, can win the ball in the air. He'd have an Aguero-style striker, something like that. But he doesn't have that, and so he thinks Hazard a low floor in that role is more useful in that context than Morata. And you know, his point about having two strikers on the bench being overkill, because when you're going to, you know, you just got to choose one or the other, so you might as well make that choice when you're selecting your 18 rather than making your choice when you're bringing one on. So all of that I thought made sense.
Well, let's be
what wrong. I did think was odd was how often Newcastle got caught was just simple balls over the top. I know Luis was playing, you know, they're really good passes and they're not easy to play. And yeah, they're not easy to control. And well, you know, Pedro's goal was brilliant touch. But Newcastle really shouldn't be getting caught like that. So you know, there's some disjunction there. If you're going to push out, you've got to get pressure on the ball. If you're not putting pressure on the ball, don't push out.
Well, Newcastle in the bottom three now, and interesting comments from Rio Ferdinand on BT's coverage. He defended Mike Ashley's lack of spending. He said, why should he spend money when he's going to sell the club? He was challenged because his Rio's number five caps are distributed through Sports Direct, so there is a business interest there, which he sort of pushed away. He said he spent $50 million of his own money on getting them back in the Premier League, which is quite funny, as if it was his own money when, you know, they had parachute payments and, you know, as Jake Humphrey said, it came out of the club's coffers, and that fans should be thanking him for getting Rafa Benitez in, even though Rafa approached Newcastle.
He also said the following day that Newcastle didn't have any debt, which is not true because Ashley, I think, is owed $140 million in personal loans he gave them. So he's just, very wrong.
Well, and claimed that Newcastle were a yo-yo club, which weren't until Ashley arrived. I mean, the two relegations they've had in the last 26, 27 years have come under Ashley. So,
well, Richard Keys agreed with...
which is always a good sign.
He said, if Rafa loves Newcastle, as he says, spend some of his own money. He's got enough. Which is an interesting concept
Richard Keys
for
paid for his
start.
Own transport and things when he worked for Sky.
Is Richard Keys also selling caps in Sports Direct, the arcade?
A bit more gloves, wouldn't it?
Have you got one of those caps?
No, I don't. Snap caps don't suit me, Bernie.
I'm shocked to hear that.
What's a snap cap?
They're not called snap caps.
Aren't they?
No, they're called snap packs.
Snapbacks.
Snap caps.
Oh, God.
Oh, man, you're so middle-aged, Barry.
I still don't know what that is.
Piss off, Rog.
I don't know either. I'm just pretending.
Snapbacks. Right. I've been labouring under a misapprehension for a long time on that one.
But what are they? They're caps.
They're
yeah, they've got a straight peak.
Oh.
Yeah.
That's what the kids wear.
As opposed
not
to a baseball
Barry
cap.
Wears.
Well, the one you're wearing right now, that backwards one, what's that? No, but it goes nicely with your baseball vest and your high tops.
Yeah. Well, Newcastle, as I say, third bottom. They head to Blackburn for an FA Cup third round replay on Tuesday. Let's move on to West Ham 1, Arsenal 0. Declan Rice's first goal for the club. Nice first time finish as well from 12 yards out. Jonathan?
Yeah, lovely finish and lovely little layoff from Sami Nasri, who I'd sort of forgotten that Sami Nasri was a good footballer. But he really is a good footballer, isn't he? He's just a bit of an idiot.
Yeah, he played really well. really well. Got some stick as well, obviously, from Arsenal fans.
Has anyone raised the issue of him sort of being absorbed back into the game and absolved after serving a drugs ban, or does no one care?
Well, I guess the excuse would be that the drugs ban was sort of a technical one, wasn't it? It wasn't that he was sort of caught taking clenbuterol or something. It was because he used a drip. And the drip, I think, contained something pretty innocent.
It was just saline, I think. Although that does perk you up considerably.
But I don't think it's a course of drugs that he would receive a lasting benefit from, you know, a la Justin Gatlin sort of style thing. But did you notice how incredibly happy Declan Rice was? I mean, people always look happy when they've scored a goal, but he was the happiest. It was as though he'd just given birth to twins.
Well,
or something.
He literally said in his interview, "It's the best birthday present I'll ever receive."
Yeah, he's that dude.
You poked a goal in against a mediocre Arsenal team.
Well,
really.
I wondered if maybe I bet Declan, North London boy, Irish. Well, Arsenal were always the Irish club when I was. I bet his dad's an Arsenal fan, or his granddad, or something like that. He seemed unusually happy about that.
Well, maybe his dad's parsimonious Victorian, who's only ever given him spinning tops and oranges for his birthday.
And finally, he's got something.
A decent present. It's birthday today, I think, so happy birthday, Declan. Do the right thing.
This will get you excited, Barry. Look what FA Ireland have just tweeted. Happy birthday to Ireland international Declan Rice in a nice Ireland shirt.
Yeah.
Pleased about that?
Well, I applaud their sort of effort to get him on board. He is an Ireland international, of that there can be no doubt, but whether or not he stays one remains to be seen. I think he'd be absolutely mad to declare for Ireland, but I still hope he does.
Just staying with West Ham, Marko Arnautović was substituted off, gave a little wave to the crowd when he went, which might suggest he's going to take that huge money move to China. We spoke about it on Thursday's pod, but how much would he be missed, Jonathan?
Oh, I think he would. I mean, I think he's a... Yeah, he's one of those players who clearly has all the talent to play at a higher, at a bigger club than West Ham. I think he's been excellent this season. He's not just technically gifted; he's also physically strong. When he's motivated, when he's focused, he's a really, really good centre forward. They'll miss him. But equally, I think if he wants to go, I don't think he's the sort of player who would sort of be. And if he's prevented from moving, I don't think he's the sort of player who would sort of go, oh, well, never mind, I'll stay here. I think the potential for big sulk is there. And then that starts to have a knock-on effect on other players as well. So if he wants to go, I think you've got to let him go.
It's kind of a strange situation, isn't it? I mean, my understanding is he's moving to a club with a state-subsidised stadium, with a manager poached from Hebei China Fortune, owned by some colourful businessmen. And, oh, no, hang on, that's the club he's at the moment. That was my joke. The point being, we like to mock the Chinese league, but I mean, I guess our league probably looks a bit odd at times as well. I mean, are we surprised Marko Arnautović has turned out to be a guy who'll move to a new club for a big wage if it's waved in front of his face? I mean, the Premier League is built on this principle and has been for the last quarter of a century. But
it's different if people are moving somewhere else.
Well, apparently so. I mean, obviously, the Chinese league, there's a few things about it might be a bit odd, but they do actually have some quite good rules in China we might want to copy. I mean, the game is played everywhere. They're building pitches. They do have a kind of salary, de facto salary cap on sort of foreign mercenary players coming in. I actually think a lot of the Chinese football rules are something we could quite decently copy in this country.
Well, West Ham have won 6 of their last 9 now. They're up to 9th. Arsenal, though, 2 points from their last 5 games. Obviously, they drew at United, lost against Southampton, drew against Brighton, then defeats against Liverpool and West Ham. The Emery revolution has hit the buffers a little bit, hasn't it?
It sort of has. I mean, I think if at the start of the season you'd said, OK, after 22 games, they'll have 41 points and they'll be sitting in fifth, you'd have sort of thought, yeah, that's probably about right. But it's been a weird season of start badly, great run, and then a bit of a wobble. And so that, I think that looks... It just feels odd, the progression. But he is building a new squad. He is building a new way of playing. He doesn't have massive resources. I think he's doing fine. However, if this present run carries on for 20 games, that becomes problematic.
Is that a new way of playing without Mesut Ozil? Can we presume he was fit yesterday but not in the squad?
Yeah, I mean, not having him on the bench I think is odd, because Arsenal looked very short of creativity, and whatever doubts you have over his application and the pressing, the defensive work he'll do, he's surely a useful option to have when you're chasing a game to bring on with 15, 20 minutes to go to create something. So that seems to me slightly odd, but Emery's obviously decided that he doesn't fancy him, and maybe he doesn't want to risk him getting injured in January.
So what will they do with him? Because it's unlikely that anyone else will pay the kind of wages he's on.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a big problem.
Well, Arsenal 5th, as you said, when Solskjaer took over at Man United, they were 8 points behind Arsenal. They're now level, which just shows you the opposite way.
Yeah, and they've closed 5 points on Chelsea as well.
Yeah, so...
So, I mean, that fourth place, which I sort of thought was impossible when Solskjaer took over, suddenly looks... I mean, not likely, but certainly possible.
Well, that'll do for part one. In part two, we'll start by rounding up the rest of the Premier League action.
In today's non-stop world, making quality time for yourself is more important than ever. When you buy a subscription to The Guardian and The Observer, you can look forward to sitting back and leafing through every page at your own pace. From the latest groundbreaking investigations to recipes, reviews, award-winning sports coverage, and more. Subscribe before the 3rd of February and you'll save up to 52% on newspaper subscriptions for a year. Just search Guardian Subscriptions.
Welcome back to part two of Guardian Football Weekly. I'll start by giving the live shows a bit of a plug. I don't need to give one of them a bit of a plug. Next Tuesday in Dublin at the Liberty Hall Theatre, the 22nd show is already sold out next Tuesday, but there is another show on Monday added by popular demand, so I'm told. Max, Barry, Paolo and Lars Sivertsen on that one. Are you looking forward to going back to Dublin, Barry?
Yes, always a pleasure.
Good. That's a surprise, because when I mentioned going to Dublin on my hen do, you said there were better places to go in Ireland.
Yes, there are. I would say Galway is one of them, probably Kilkenny. And I'm loath to grudgingly admit Cork is one of them, because they're kind of a bit pleased with themselves down there. But I would choose for, well, I wouldn't go on a hen do, obviously, for many reasons. The main one being that I'm not a woman, and the other main one being that they seem like just the worst kind of social events imaginable that invariably end in tears and gin-sodden acrimony.
Well, much like our last trip to Dublin.
Yeah.
Burnley 2, Fulham 1.
Ah, yeah.
And two own goals for Burnley, even though the first Jeff Hendricks strike looked like it was going in anyway, even if Brian hadn't have stuck his knee out, so a little bit unfair. But Burnley now 7 points above Fulham, their third straight win in the league. They deserved the win, although they didn't have a shot on target, but that's the stat that everyone will take from this game.
Oh, well, sorry, I always feel you should talk like that when you start talking about Burnley. Yeah, I mean, they'll be fine, won't they? It's quite common for teams that are run on such fine margins as they are, so carefully coached, and quite a strong first 11 to have little dips if something goes slightly wrong with the machinery. But they're so well organised, they'll be fine. Which probably isn't something you could say about Fulham, who, when you find yourself going ahead after 2 minutes and then scoring two own goals to lose against a relegation rival, he probably tests even Claudio Ranieri's capacity for remaining in.
I thought they played quite well second half, Fulham, actually. They were a bit unlucky with the Vieto shot that hit Tarkowski on the line, and sort of, well, I could have bounced anywhere and somehow bounced down and up and over the bar. I don't know, obviously Fulham in a position where they can't have too many of those days, but I think to an extent it was just one of those days.
Fantastic goal, though, from Schürrle.
Oh, brilliant goal, yeah. I also, were they only the sixth team ever to win a Premier League game without having a shot on target?
Yeah.
And I was shocked to see that Sunderland won one of those against West Brom in the 15-point season. So we only got 15 points despite winning a game without having a shot on target.
Well, there's 10 away defeats now for Fulham. They're 5 points from safety. Do you think Ranieri can turn this around? You said it's just an off day for them.
Well, I mean, not an off day, just a day when things didn't quite go for them. I think they've definitely improved under Ranieri. They're starting to keep clean sheets. But, you know, he inherited a bad situation and it's probably not quite getting better quickly enough. Well, they've taken 9 points from 9 games in the Ranieri, I think.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Quite enough. So, you know, there are little flickers there that could ignite into something that will carry them to safety. But, you know, obviously they're not in a good position.
And it is quite shocking they're in that position because I think at the start of the season, a lot of people expected them and Wolves to do incredibly well. And Wolves are doing okay, but Fulham, on paper, their squad should not be anywhere near the bottom of the table.
Well, I think their other problem is there's sort of a dearth of teams to collapse for them to overhaul. So they may well overhaul Cardiff. I think Newcastle's position is slightly false. I think Newcastle, you know, probably will pull themselves out of it. But Burnley and Southampton are both improving. So it's a really tough position that they're in.
Well, another team that are improving is Southampton. They beat Leicester 2-1. Shane Long's first goal since April, although...
Was it? I mean, he probably will get it, but I think that might be Schmeichel's own goal. I think it was going wide, so it hit Schmeichel's hand and went in. But, I mean, poor lad, he had a tough one. Let him have it.
It's Southampton 7 points from their last 3 away games. Hasenhüttl doing a good job there, Barney.
Yeah, it's a revolution. It's the Hasenhüttl revolution. But he's a compelling figure, isn't he? It shows how... Well, I mean, presumably referees are now too frightened to constantly be biased against Southampton, which destroyed the career of Mark Hughes. They prefer Hasenhüttl. But football is often quite simple creatures and a quite simple game. Someone who comes in and has a plan and seems compelling and he's just a huge man who shouts and hugs his players. It's obviously given everyone a big lift, and the players have been very quick to say, yes, it's much better now. It's completely different to what it was before.
I have noticed Manchester United players and Southampton players both very quick to slag off their previous managers at every opportunity. Like James Ward-Prowse was quite withering in his assessment of...
It says here, we have a clear structure and a plan of what to do with and without the ball. The difference has been unbelievable. Hi, Mark. But Hasenhüttl is great, isn't he? Yeah, yeah.
Well, that was an extraordinary performance from Jan Valery as well. I mean...
Yeah, because Southampton had to work extra hard.
Should have been sent off for studs up challenge.
Stroke of half-time.
On Chilwell, and then eventually gets a second yellow for another foul. So,
and somebody who... Everyone says should have got a yellow. Jamie Vardy for his
obvious dive. It should have been a booking, clearly. Yeah, and there's something very odd about that rule that they can't review that because the referee wasn't deceived by it.
Yeah, it's strange. But Puel under a bit of pressure now. There's boos at half time. He said they're not his concern after the game, which is a bit of a strange rebuttal. They sort of asked him, "Well, you know, these are the fans. They're not happy. Well, not my concern."
Well, I imagine it is very much his concern. I mean, Leicester are having a very weird season, you know, on a number of levels. Obviously, the tragedy, the helicopter crash, and then they're beating teams you would not expect them to have any chance of beating and losing against teams you'd expect them to beat quite comfortably. So I can kind of understand the fans' frustrations, but I think Puel gets too much abuse for games he does lose and not enough credit for some of the ones he wins.
Yeah, they've won three of their last six.
But, you know, it's Leicester. They won the championship a few years ago, but that was a sort of a freakish anomaly, and they're unlikely to win it again anytime soon. And, you know, but short of being one place higher, they're about par.
They beat Chelsea and Man City in the last six. But isn't that FA Cup defeat, though? You know, people say, FA Cup's losses, people don't care. I think fans do care, and I think Leicester fans in particular were hurt that they were put out by Newport.
Yeah, and it's the style of football, isn't it? It's this strange existential angst that football fans suffer from now, where what can Leicester do? What can they literally achieve? They can battle about whether they're going to be 7th or 13th. They're not going to go down. They're not going to threaten to do anything else. They might possibly try and win a cup. And so you end up, because the natural state of football is to rage against something, you end up raging against whatever you can find. And it's now you're going to get sacked for playing two holding midfielders. That's unacceptable. You know, this man must lose his job for playing two holding midfielders, I heard someone say on the radio.
Southampton face Derby in their FA Cup third round replay on Wednesday. Let's move on to Palace against Watford. Watford won this one 2-1. A comeback in the last 25 minutes gave Watford the win. And it was cleverly with the winner, almost sort of the forgotten man at Watford, Jonathan.
Yeah, I mean, it's the first game back after a year out with an Achilles problem. So, yeah, it's great for him. A slightly odd game, another game where Palace had more than enough chances to have won it, but yeah, they keep doing that, don't they?
Well, Watford have got more points away from home so far than they did in all of last season. But Palace, Jonathan, having a bit of a weird season, aren't they?
Yeah, they are, and they're almost certainly going to be all right. And Roy Hodgson, I think, is wise enough to ensure panic doesn't set in and to make sure they're fine. But I guess if you were Fulham or Newcastle, they are a team who you think maybe we could rein them back in. But ideally, if you're Fulham, you wouldn't have given them an 8-point start.
Well, let's move on to Everton against Bournemouth. 2-0 Everton. This was yesterday's game as well. Not an awful lot happened in this game. Kurt Zouma's header and then Dominic Calvert-Lewin in the 95th minute to wrap it up. But a big win for Marco Silva, Barry, because he has been under pressure.
He has been under pressure. I think when he was at Hull, he was sort of hailed as this messiah and then went to Watford. And that went a bit wrong for him when he got sacked. He obviously had his head turned by Everton, and I don't think he's as good as some people claim or used to claim he would be. He may well become that good, nor do I think he's as bad as some critics are saying. But yeah, Everton are having a very meh season, and he needed that win.
Bournemouth need a win.
I didn't need him to have that win, though, because I had an argument with a Wolves fan on the internet, as you do, and they...
Obviously.
Yeah, we were over who were better, Wolves or Everton. So now, at the moment, Everton are better. Although I still don't think they are. I think this table I'm looking at, there must be a mistake in it, because Wolves should clearly be above Everton.
Well, they might be after tonight.
Yeah.
Bournemouth are really stuck in a rut, aren't they? Two wins since October.
Yeah, they should probably sack Eddie Howe and just get someone else in.
But Bournemouth do this, don't they? They have long streaks where they go unbeaten and long streaks where they cannot win. And it all evens out in the end, but it's not sort of win one, draw one, lose one. It's like win eight, lose eight.
And they don't just lose. They get absolutely hammered by someone because everything suddenly falls to pieces.
But it also doesn't seem to matter because they're still 12th. It's like Burnley last season who, without winning a game... one game out of 11, you know, either side of Christmas, only dropped one place in the table. It's quite hard to get relegated from the Premier League.
Well, and you end up with some quite boring teams. I mean, Bournemouth are, it's not a very fashionable thing today, but they're quite boring, aren't they? I mean,
Do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I know we're meant to say, and obviously it's a wonderful job and they're brilliantly run and really, but
I like watching them play.
They're okay to watch. Would you miss Burnley particularly? Now you've accepted that Sean Dyche has done an amazing job. But the extent of their ambition is to hang around in that area, and it's great while you can do it. Would you miss them? Would you rather swap them for some horrible, incontinent, giant, failing giant like Leeds who tries to get into Europe and fails? I mean, wouldn't that be more entertaining? I know it's not fair or right.
Certainly the Premier League would like that.
Yeah, the Premier League probably would, because they're selling
entertainment. The Premier League are sort of... they will admit unofficially, certain people at the Premier League, that it's not great for them to have teams who don't have a support base around the rest of the world. That a game between, say, Leeds and Derby on Friday night gets a big audience from people who were whose football consciousness was formed in the 70s. And with the best one in the world, Bournemouth or Brighton or Burnley are not going to generate that.
Well, it's not just that the consciousness, they sort of have more fans. You know, those fans are not all... old men.
That's also true.
Leeds is a one city club from quite a big city, and it's a kind of club that will have dreams of grandeur rather than dreams of floating around in 10th place with everyone saying you're doing a really good job.
Well, we will get on to Leeds because there's a lot to talk about with Leeds in part three. But before then, Cardiff 0, Huddersfield 0. I saw a tweet from a Cardiff fan saying this is the most boring Premier League game he's ever seen, which I will go against, because I went to Reading against Norwich in November 2012, which was also a 0-0, where I don't think there was a moment of quality in the entire 90 minutes. I think Grant Holt had a header that was about 3 yards wide and that was it. There was no drama. Unlike this game, where Huddersfield were giving a penalty in the 76th minute, then they had it taken away from them, which was just a strange kind of incident because it did look like a penalty. It was Joe Bennett on Florent Hadjonai, had an arm across him, sort of brings him down as they both run towards the ball and run towards the penalty area. Lee Mason gave it. The assistant referee intervenes and told him the foul should be the other way round. You can understand why David Wagner was incandescent after the game.
I mean, I have to say, I'm not 100% convinced it was a penalty. I'm a bit, it might have been a penalty, it might not.
But what I'd love to know,
players run alongside each other quite a lot and things get tangled up and sometimes there's a foul.
We've got to stop. We can't have a discussion about whether something was a penalty or not. We can't do it.
Go on, Barney, try.
No,
just for me, this is Barney. All
that this is what happened. You hear it all the time. Wasn't it a penalty? Who knows? You know, it was given one way. Someone has to make a judgment.
This is the point, that it was given one way. Then what did the linesman say? What did the assistant referee seen that made him absolutely convinced the ref had got it wrong?
Well, he saw that it was just a little bit of contact, wasn't really a penalty. I disagree with you. I had a better view. That's the end of it.
Well,
no one's biased. It's not
a
massive corruption scandal.
I don't think it's a massive corruption scandal.
We end up talking about this because nothing else happened in the game. None of us have really seen it well enough to analyse the tactics or what really happened. And so we just end up banging on about a man's opinion about something that was really marginal in a game which is played on the edge of... I mean, fouls define football. It's all about what you can and can't do in relation to another human being. And someone has to make that judgment. There is no written constitution. The laws are always a matter of interpretation. And so you end up talking about this because it's an easy discussion and it fuels the tribalism many people feel.
It doesn't actually feel that
injustice.
Easy right now. my point is merely that in what is manifestly a grey area, I'm intrigued by the certainty of a linesman to overrule the referee, thus creating a huge talking point that probably would not have been a huge talking point had the penalty been given.
But to be fair, I don't think this was particularly this game's huge talking point. That came afterwards.
You're referring to Neil Warnock in his post-match press. Well, let's get on to that then, if we don't want to discuss the penalty.
No, we could talk about the penalty forever. Let's keep talking about it.
No,
it may have been a penalty or it may not have been one. Two people had different opinions.
And on that note, Brexit. Neil Warnock, his post-match presser, to hell with the rest of the world, football-wise and in every aspect.
But I mean, presumably Warnock was asked about... transfers,
yeah.
And in relation to Brexit, which seems like something most people haven't really thought about. But yeah, it is an odd thing, and it's kind of depressing to hear someone, a very wealthy man, age 70, whose wealth is personal wealth and success is based on basically the European Union made the Premier League. I mean, the freedom of movement and the freedom to sell television rights, all of that deregulation made the Premier League. It's countries like Iceland have massively benefited from the fact that their players can come here. The league is you know, we're kind of conjoined now, and it's really helped their football. And to hear someone saying that, it's a very depressing kind of parable of so many things about Brexit that people do find depressing. Maybe Neil was misquoted and has other views, but those views are kind of depressing.
Let's get on to Spain now. Another weekend football in La Liga. On the line to talk about it, Sid Lowe. Sid, hi, how are you doing?
Very well, thanks. How are you?
Yeah, all good, thank you. Let's start with Betis against Real Madrid. An interesting game. Real Madrid had just 26% possession, but they still won 2-1. A late free kick from Dani Ceballos. Tell us all about it.
Well, I mean, it was always quite likely that Betis would dominate possession. You know, we were talking about our side with Kike Setién, who'd been quite obsessive about maintaining the ball, about dominating teams, about keeping it. There is sometimes, I think, a risk of them overplaying, or not so much overplaying as not finding a way through, not having a cutting edge. What Real Madrid did for this game was to go for five at the back. They effectively had a five-man defence, two defensive midfielders in front of it, and held back, and I mean, in the first half perhaps they pressed a little bit higher, but held back and waited for Betis, and on the break, at least in the first half, were probably the better side, probably felt like they were in control of the game a little bit, felt like they had the better opportunities, went in at half time, won the luck, but in the second half, when Betis I think got to grips a bit more with the way that Real Madrid had played, it was Betis just totally dominating. Now perhaps not creating as many chances as they would like, and certainly Liverpool fans will recognise that in the fact that Balogun must have put in 15 crosses, of which I think only one hit its target. But Betis kept on going and kept on going, and I think there's a temptation from some to see this as Madrid defending well, resisting, showing personality. But actually, I thought what it was a team at the mercy of another side. Betis got the equaliser, didn't maybe create as many chances as they would like, but were completely on top of Real Madrid all the way through the half. And then one bad mistake, one bad challenge, a free kick, an incredibly bad wall, bad position from the goalkeeper, and Real Madrid win 2-1. And you know, it's a kind of game, I suppose, that afterwards people say, well, this could be a turning point, emotionally it could be very important. But the truth is, Madrid was still pretty awful, and certainly in the second half, I thought they were very poor indeed.
Well, that win takes them up into fourth after Alaves drew at Girona. Real now with the same points as Sevilla, who lost 2-0 at Athletic Bilbao. Iñaki Williams with both the goals. Bilbao have now won 11 of their 22 points this season in the last five games, so things are looking up for them, Sid.
Yes, change of manager Asier Garitano has really changed things. I think there's a sense that they look a little bit more like Athletic Bilbao should, a bit more direct, a little bit more aggressive. They were in terrible trouble, and of course the risk of a first ever relegation in their history, which I think would have enormous consequences, not just for them, but I think emotionally it would be have quite a big impact on Spanish football as a whole. You know, Athletic Bilbao with Barcelona and Real Madrid, one of the only three teams to have never been out of the first division. And Iñaki Williams' goals are extraordinary. The first one is a brilliant goal, taken very well, hit extremely hard. And this is the first time he had scored at home for Athletic Bilbao in 770 days. His last 15 goals for Athletic had all been away from home. You know, it's 41 games without a goal at somewhere. So he scored this brilliant goal. And Athletic are in the lead against a Sevilla side who, you know, as you just said, were seen as a contender for the league title and been playing very well until the last couple of weeks. And then with 5 minutes to go, there's a ball played out to him on the edge of the centre circle, and he turns first time. And everybody, when he turns, I mean, everybody knows he's quick. And when he turns, there's a very slight hint of a space. And I think when he turns, everybody thinks, run, go on, run. But nobody quite expects that. I mean, the acceleration is just something else, and he goes through two players who kind of close like sliding doors and don't get there in time, and he just keeps going, and he seems to get faster and faster and faster as he runs. And there's this kind of sense that with every footstep he takes, another 1,000 people stand up off their seat in the stadium, and the noise rises, and it's almost as if the whole thing goes together. He goes around the goalkeeper and puts it in. He runs 56 metres in about 7 seconds. They were suggesting to tell you that he'd reached a top speed of 38 kilometres an hour during the run. And it was just something else. And as I say, the acceleration was astonishing to see. And it was fantastically graceful as well, the way that he pulled away from it. And as I say, and the emotional impact, I think, of it is huge, because it had been so long since he scored at home. He said after the game that he felt like crying. And you can see there's a brilliant photograph of players piling onto him, all screaming, neck muscles kind of bulging and veins sticking out and stuff. And you can see the kind of the emotion of it. And I think people who look at football and kind of, you know, sort of look down at the emotion that it causes and stuff, I think you just have to watch that goal, and just the excitement, the kind of the thrill of watching him run is really something else.
Yeah, it was a great goal, and someone else who has scored literally hundreds of great goals, Lionel Messi, he scored again as Barcelona beat Eibar 3-0. That was his 400th goal in La Liga. Sid, is there anything new you can tell us about Messi?
You know what I quite liked in a way, and this is almost the definition of the absurdity of Leo Messi, is after the game, one of the things that the manager, Ernesto Valverde, said was, well, he'll score 500. And there's a bit of me that thinks, there you go, well, let's talk about him, we scored 500 then. And I suppose this is the Messi paradox, isn't it? This is the problem that we have with Messi, is that he is so brilliant so often. Actually, this weekend, by the way, about the worst I've seen him play for 3 or 4 months. Based on scores. And you look at him, he just makes brilliance so routine. I don't think we talk about him as much as we probably should, but in a way, it's partly because, as you say, what do you say about him? Well, there he is. There's another 400 goals. Great. Well done, Leo. Let's have a chat when you get to 500.
Well, Sid, thank you very much for your time.
Cheerio. Bye.
Cheers. Bye. Well, that's all for part two. In part three, we'll start with Leeds and all the news from the Championship and the Football League. Mm-hmm. Welcome back to part three. Before we talk about championship matters, there was some sad news yesterday. Former Leeds and South Africa striker Phil Masinga passed away of cancer at the age of 49. He signed for Leeds along with Lucas Radebe in 1994 and was at Elland Road 2 years before moving to Swiss side St Gallen and then clubs in Italy. Masinga was best known for scoring the goal against the Congo that took South Africa to their first World Cup in 1998. May he rest in peace. Now, let's go get on to the football. Leeds comfortably beat Derby 2-0 on Friday night, but it was all about what happened before the game. Jonathan, I'm coming to you because this is Marcelo Bielsa and you are the resident Bielsa expert.
Right.
And you're not... This story intrigued a lot of people. It doesn't intrigue you.
I just think it's that big a deal. I mean, Bielsa's done this throughout his career.
We should say, before, for anyone who doesn't know, Derby spotted somebody lurking in the fence of their training ground on Thursday, and Bielsa admitted it was a Leeds employee that he'd sent to spy on them.
Yeah, but I mean, Bielsa has always done this. He's not the only manager who does this. The English media habitually do this around major tournaments to try and find out what the England team's going to be. It might be ungentlemanly, it might be slightly unsporting, but he's not trespassing, he's not actually doing anything wrong. You're allowed to kind of go and look through a fence if you want to. I'm surprised by how worked up people have got over it. I'm surprised as well that Frank Lampard allowed himself to be sort of to be drawn into making complaints about it, which I think probably gave Leeds a psychological advantage.
Yeah, a lot of people are having a bit of a moan at Lampard because he sort of questioned Bielsa's morals. Someone quoted a newspaper interview with Andre Villas-Boas just after he joined Jose Mourinho's staff at Chelsea, where he said he regularly travels to training grounds incognito to look at opponents.
I just think it happens a lot. I think it happens all the time. That's why clubs, they try and make their training grounds hard to look at, but It's very hard to stop. Training grounds are of necessity quite big, and they're not prisons. I've been bewildered by how serious people have taken this. I mean, Bielsa is known for doing this. He's known for the thoroughness of his research, and he would see watching people's training as being part of his job, part of the game. You can say it's ungentlemanly. I don't know what law he's supposed to have broken by standing on what, as far as I understand, was public land looking through a fence.
Well, what should happen then? What should happen, Barney? Should Leeds face any punishment? Should any punishment?
No, they shouldn't. I mean, there's no law that's been broken or no rule that's been broken. And as Jonathan says, it has always happened. I remember Gary Lineker telling that story about being told there was someone watching him at the 1990 World Cup while he was practicing his penalty, I think it was before the Cameroon game. And so he deliberately hit them to the other side as a kind of, and nobody complained. We didn't try and get Cameroon or whoever it was thrown out of the World Cup. And it actually sort of worked in their favour. I was surprised by Frank Lampard being quite so shocked and stunned and amazed at someone wanting to study another team's tactics in that way. I mean, I guess it's kind of funny. There's the kind of, the binoculars and the change of clothing aspect. But it is a funny story of someone trying to do their job as thoroughly as possible. And the fact I found the Bielsa interview on television hilarious.
He was so brazen about it.
He was Lee Harvey Oswald being wheeled out in front of the media after he'd shot the president. What would we want him to do? It's not cheating. Diving and fouling are cheating. This is just trying to find out about tactics.
Well, Lampard was honest after the game and he said, his team got beaten 2-0 by the better side, which Leeds were comfortably. As I say, they won 2-0. Barry, what is your take? Do you take the moral high ground on this?
I just think it's quite funny. And like Barney says, the levels of outrage are quite weird when quite a lot of the people who are outraged don't seem that fussed about actual cheating. But yeah, it was just quite amusing.
Well, to be honest, even if we say this is cheating, which I don't think any of us particularly think it is, even if we did say that, it's kind of victimless. If you go over the top in the challenge, you might break somebody's leg. If you dive in the box, you're sort of breaching the contract of the game that says that you don't dive, because if everybody dives, the game would become completely unpoliceable and impossible to enact. If you try and look at somebody practicing,
It's not completely true, because every manager who doesn't do that will find out exactly.
I think they all should do that.
But they don't, and they'll find out exactly who's playing when we find out, you know, an hour and a half before kickoff. They won't know the set piece, but they'll react in games to what they see happening. You know, for example, the Pochettino thing yesterday, he hadn't been spying on United in Dubai, so he suddenly was as shocked as everyone else to find this slightly rejigged formation and had to adapt to it. Now, you over the course of a season, if you know or have a very clear idea what the other team's been practicing before every single game, you're going to have 5 more points at the end of it, because you're going to stop that goal in the 7th minute that you couldn't have seen coming because you didn't know about this. There is a benefit to it.
Are you saying tactics are important, Barney?
Well, it depends what's wrong about them. There are some really good tactical people out there on the internet. I don't know if you've seen them. You know,
some good books out there as
really
well.
Good books, yeah. You should have a look. But I think there is an advantage to be gained from it, but that doesn't mean that everyone shouldn't work as hard to try and find that advantage. And also, you can bet the players loved it. You'd love your manager spying on things and telling you things. I bet it gave them a massive boost.
I also think if there's any manager you would want defending a supposed fault, it is Bielsa, just because of the way he, you know, he answers any question in the same way, which is to look down and go on these massive circumlocutions. And yeah, he's totally unfazed by it. And yeah, I think it just builds his legend. I think it makes him greater. You know, it's no different to Brian Clough watering the pitch at the baseball ground before playing Benfica. To you know, he's our cheat, and therefore not that this is cheating, but he's our
rogue.
Yeah, it's a good word. Yeah, our rogue, and therefore you know they love him even more. And they are what they're 4 points clear now.
So yeah, Wilson, I back RG cheat.
Yeah, and that's a position I'd take on many things. As
what
you know.
About Diego Maradona's handball? Are you okay with that?
Yeah, not especially bothered. Which one? The one against England or the one against the Soviet Union, which you never talk about?
The one against England is the only one that matters.
Right, okay.
As you said, Leeds are 4 points clear now at the top. Derby are 6. We should say the FA are investigating, and Leeds released a statement to say the club will look to work with our head coach and his staff to remind them of the integrity and honesty, which are the foundations that Leeds United is built on. They also said...
Well, that's the funniest thing about the whole thing, that particular sentence.
Are you suggesting that Leeds...
I'm just putting that out there.
All right. Well, you said it, not me. Norwich started the weekend second, but are now third on goal difference after a draw at West Brom, who are 3 points behind in fourth. Norwich 12 games unbeaten away from home. We've got a lot of injuries, still managed to salvage a point thanks to super sub Jordan Rhodes in the 83rd minute. He scored with his first touch, and the sub that came on with him, Kenny McLean, put in a fantastic ball with only his third touch. So, not all in all, quite a good weekend for Norwich, salvaging a point there. Keeps West Brom 3 points behind them. Sheffield United, though, on a great run. They beat QPR 1-0 to move up to second. David McGoldrick with the only goal of the game. That's QPR's first defeat in 6. Middlesbrough 4th. They beat Birmingham 2-1. Britta Sombolonga on as a sub to get the winner 8 minutes from time. Bristol City also on a good run. They're now just 2 points off the playoffs. They beat Bolton 2-1 to extend their unbeaten run to 10 games in the league and the cup. At the bottom, Ipswich managed only their third win over the season over Rotherham. On loan, Hull striker Will Keane scored the only goal, and James Collins started at the back for Ipswich.
You must be very sad to see them down there, Melissa.
You know, I'm completely unbiased in my professional role. Well,
you said to me when Paul Lambert was pictured at his presentation as Ipswich manager, it was like, I quote, a dagger through your heart.
Yeah, it did really hurt. And there's still, we play them soon. We play them at the beginning of February. And the thought of Ipswich winning and then Paul Lambert giving it the big one to the Ipswich fans coming on the Carrow Road pitch. God, it does really hurt. It really hurts.
But they are terrible. I was at the Den for the Millwall. Millwall beat them 3-0. They lost 3-0 to Millwall. And, you know, they were really poor.
But yeah. I mean, do you actually want to see them go down? Because I always find this with Newcastle. I obviously don't want them to win anything.
Yeah,
and it's
no,
quite funny when things are going bad for them. But I don't really want them to suffer and struggle. I'm aware I'm saying this within two divisions above us.
Ipswich fans really celebrated when Norwich went down to League One. But then we had such a great season. It was so much fun.
Well, it's always a danger, isn't it?
Yeah. So, you know, would you rather them sort of limp along in the Championship, not doing much and fighting relegation, or, you know, win games in League One and have fun? know.
And there's a danger that the teams just keep going down and sort of disappear, and you never get a derby again. Yeah. Or if you do get it, it's in the checker
you,
trade.
You can only enjoy derby games once they're over and you've won, or you've got a positive result at least.
Yeah,
not, no, you can't enjoy
true,
the build-up.
Yeah. No, I don't mean once someone in the same division as Newcastle. That's an awful thing.
The funny thing is there's a book available in the Norwich Club shop, which is called Bragging Rights, which has got every single Norwich win over Ipswich and sort of a passage about each game. And the foreword is done by Paul Lambert. and it was only published this year as well. So, yeah, I think we play them on February the 10th. So that'll be a big game. This just in, by the way, from Daniel Taylor. Martin O'Neill poised to become the new manager of Nottingham Forest. What do we make of that?
Well, I'm pleased for Martin O'Neill because presumably that means he's in a happy place in his own life if he's taking a club football job. What could possibly go wrong?
Well, his anti-Dudleavian tactics could be found out again.
Yeah, is that going to happen at Forest? I mean, it doesn't seem like a bad idea, does it?
He's replaced Karanka, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah,
seems an odd appointment, but I suppose...
Well, it's just an emotional one, isn't it?
But the Championship is full of managers who think that they're creating the next Ajax. There's a load of really bad footballing teams in that league who are really tedious to watch. Maybe a little bit of old-school Martin O'Neill might be a good thing.
Well, Forest lost 2-0 at Reading on Saturday. They're ninth. They are only 4 points off the playoffs, though, so, you know, they're still in the mix. Moving on to League One, Portsmouth lost at home to Blackpool, but neither Luton or Sunderland could take full advantage as they drew 1-1 at the Stadium Light. Luton had to play with 10 men for the last 20 minutes as well, didn't they, Jonathan?
Yeah, they did. I mean, Sunderland haven't been playing well for at least a month, I'd say. And I think this becomes properly worrying if Josh Madger does leave, which I think is becoming increasingly likely. I sort of do understand Sunderland's logic in selling him. If they do end up selling him, that his contract's up in summer 2020. So this is the last window when they get proper money for him. He's a really good finisher. He has a lot of attributes as a forward, but he's probably not quite as good yet with his back to goal as Jack Ross would like. He prefers the Charlie Wyke style forward, but Wyke's just coming back from injury. Clearly isn't quite right yet. And I think although Sunderland have gone on some absurd run of games without failing to score, they do look a bit short of creativity at times.
Sorry.
No, they do. the Bradford game on Boxer Day was the last time I saw them live. They kept getting in great crossing positions, then there was nobody in the box. They seemed to really struggle to get men in the box to take advantage of getting in good positions out wide. So there's something about, they're still doing well, but the balance isn't quite right at the minute. And I guess the good thing is in their slightly sticky run, they are drawing games rather than losing them. But it is frustrating when Portsmouth get beat at home by Blackpool that Sunderland can't take advantage, having taken the lead and playing 20 minutes against 10 men.
Well, Charlton in fourth won 3-0 at Shrewsbury, and Barnsley, who are fifth, beat Bradford City 3-0. There's an incredible goal from that game. I'm not sure if anyone's seen it, but Barnsley's second goal, it's sort of a flick. Mamadou Tiam flicks it with his heel over a defender to Alex Mowat, who first time then puts on a plate for Kiefer Moore, who just finishes. Really good team goal. On to League Two. At the top, Lincoln City drew 2-2 at Swindon. They had to play the last 35 minutes with 9 men as well. Jason Shackle shown a second yellow for dissent, and Lincoln had Andrade sent off 11 minutes before half time. But they drew 2-2 despite being 2-0 up.
Jason Shackle must be about 50, is he?
Jason Shackle?
He's one of your old boys.
Yeah, ex-Norwich, yeah. I liked him at Norwich, actually. But
and then he was on The Hills.
The Hills?
A reality TV show, Melissa, starring lots of...
The Hills are set in America. I don't think he was on that.
He was.
What?
He was dating one of the ladies in it.
Yes. How do you know that and I don't?
I don't know. It's remarkable. But I think I've pulled it back from the brink with the...
He's 35 anyway.
Oh, okay.
Oh, you have. I've
made it
snap,
up.
Snap caps.
My snapback. Faux pas.
Shame.
I've never seen a lower bar that's so light to just clamber over.
Harry was punching the air there just to make that clear.
I should mention before I go that on Thursday's pod, I accidentally called Nathan Jones English to the wrath of lots of people in Wales who reminded me on Twitter. I did apologise, and I think I made amends because I said that when I was a kid, Chris Llewellyn used to be my favourite Norwich player, and I had a Norwich City pencil case, and on the back of it, in a Tippex pen, I wrote Llewellyn for England, without knowing that he was Welsh. And then I faced the wrath of my dad, who said, there'd never be four L's in an English name. Of course he's Welsh. So he had to get me a new pencil case. You look like that, Barry. Give me another English surname with four L's
in it. No, I was just trying to think of one, but I probably won't be able to.
See. So I apologise to all Luton fans and Welsh people for that. And Fake of Others is presenting on Thursdays, and she's a Luton fan, so she can make up for my horrendous error.
Millwall has four L's in it, and it's in England.
Very much so.
Not a surname, though, is it?
Could be.
Quite a lot of very, very English fans.
Oh, I've just thought of one. Oh, actually, he might be Welsh, though.
Who?
Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen.
Oh, he's Welsh. He's Bowen.
Is he Welsh?
Yeah, I mean, his name Llewellyn is Llewellyn. It's the same name.
Oh, yeah. Oh, Mark Bowen's Welsh as well. Oh, his only has three L's in. His Llewellyn only has three L's, so... So it's fine. It's fine. I think it's all right. Anyway, on that note, that's the end of today's podcast. Jonathan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Barney, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Barry, thanks for coming back from Malta to join us.
You're welcome.
That's
thank
all
you.
From me, Faker Others. We'll be presenting the pod on Thursday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.